Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, I'm Ian Stone and welcome to the show. Yes, it's that time again. The football's on. So this week we'll be reacting to the best of the action from the weekend, going over some fairly gargantuan Premier League spending during the transfer window. And to do that, we've got guests who would grace any panel show on a satellite channel with a low budget. It's Jeff Norcott and Glenn Moore.
Hello.
Morning.
Hello.
Nice to see you, chaps. Glenn, your debut on the show. We're very excited to have you.
Thanks.
What have you noticed this week?
Well, Ian, I view everything through the England squad lens. And I'm delighted to say what I've noticed is this past week is the first week since Euro 2020 where Jadon Sancho, Bukayo Saka and Marcus Rashford, who all missed penalties, got on the score sheet in the Premier League. And I think in advance of Qatar, that means we're going to win it. I'm so certain of that. It's really cheered me up.
I love any omen, Jeff. Absolutely anything. We'll take them,
yeah.
Won't we? Let's be fair.
I mean, look, I'm boycotting that World Cup. Until when's the first game? I'm boycotting it until England's first game.
I think it's about November the 18th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Principled stand against bigotry of all kinds. But I also really, I hate bigotry, but I love football. So it's a tough one.
Yeah. Jeff, what about you?
What I've noticed is, look, my club, AFC Wimbledon, we've had a mixed start to the season. But we did win a game in the Papa John's trophy against Aston Villa B team. But is it? I don't know if it's even still called the Papa John's, but it's a disgusting format, that, right? Essentially, it was a cup for the lower leagues, level 3 and 4. And I don't know why it existed, but it did. And then suddenly, Premier League teams went, oh, it's all right if we just send our B team into your competition because we've got a couple of future millionaires that haven't had a lot of in-game experiences. So they sort of dropped down. And so even though we beat Aston Villa 2-1, we didn't really, because it's got B after the name. And I hate the fact that they have to even say the B team. Why can't they just say, look, we're going to call it Aston Villa, but we're going to send the resis, all right? We're going to send the reserves. And it's just something, it's something so patronising about it. It's like a comedian just dropping into a local comedy club who does a bit of telly, you know, and just a local act having to pull out. And on that note, I will actually be at the Norwich Giggle Factory this Friday. A little bit of a late book in there. Just trying out a few bits.
Yeah. Who's the TV comedian who's on, though,
John? Yeah, the TV comedian is John Bishop, actually. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
They needed someone who could sell tickets.
So we've dished it out on this show. It's only right and proper that we should take it. After the unalloyed glee of the first 2 weeks as we all revelled in Manchester United parlous start to the season, they've now won 4 games in a row and are only 3 points behind the team they beat at the weekend, and that's Arsenal. So we feel duty bound to big up, as the kids say, their latest performance, even if it was against my own team. Jeff, for Manchester United, was it just a simple case of paying less attention to the moody bloke? And could we all maybe take that lesson on board in our own lives?
Sorry, moody bloke, who do you... Is that personal? And I also like the fact that you said we can talk about it even if they beat Arsenal. I'd say especially because they beat Arsenal. I think that's part of the that's part of the appeal. I mean, look, I think top flight football is fundamentally morally corrupt. So I just enjoy it when people are miserable. So for a while, Man United fans were miserable based on 2 games or something. There was this long period of about a week where United weren't good. And then they got good. And now all the other top flight clubs are miserable because United are good. So you can't lose, right? If you just trade in misery like me, you can't lose. And it does bug me, though, with United fans. This kind of like revolution against the club's ownership, it's so principled, isn't it? Right up till they win a couple of games. They're like, we are fundamentally against the financial leveraging of Manchester. What's that? We beat Liverpool, right? They've got no legs. They even started like AFC Wimbledon. They started FC United and Manchester, but they just all carried on going to Man United as well. That is not how you do a Phoenix club.
Clint, I never thought that I'd say that Jeff Norcott would be the moral compass on this show.
Yeah.
But here we are. It is a bit of a shock. I mean, I was talking about Ronaldo, of course, there, who they have dropped and won all their games since they've dropped him. Glenn, do you think all right-minded football fans need to start a petition to get Harry Maguire back in this United team as quickly as possible?
No, I really enjoyed in the Arsenal match that once Man U had a bit of confidence, they brought Harry Maguire on almost as an act of showboating. Everyone felt really confident, and like I think bringing Harry Maguire on for the last 10 minutes is the equivalent of like dribbling along your own goal line. It's like, oh, are we gonna screw it up? I thought it was really brave to bring him on.
Yeah, sorry, they were patronising my team there, but that's fair enough. The game, of course, could have been very different if Arsenal's disallowed goal had been allowed to stand by VAR, but there was contact and it was given. But there were a couple of VAR decisions. Which Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman could not have got any more wrong. Glenn, is the problem that referees have no more appreciation of football than I have of quantum mechanics?
No, the problem is that referees have to make the decision on the pitch. I think if you're going to make a big VAR decision, you should be allowed to do it in a separate room off the pitch, like the rest of the VAR people. Or you should be allowed to put a big cloak over your head like people taking an old-timey sort of photograph. Because I'm not sure about you, I can't pee in a public urinal if another person is there, and I cannot even tie my shoelaces if another person is watching, let alone make a history-making decision in front of tens of thousands of people. I think the issue is one of privacy. The refs are just under far too much pressure to be able to do it. I do think, however, though, that there needs to be some sort of punishment for refs who get VAR decisions wrong, and you know that they themselves should be booked, or that there should be other forfeits, like they should have to eat a full cooked breakfast on the pitch and carry on reffing if they make a VAR decision incorrectly. There needs to be some sort of comeuppance or consequence or something, because some of the decisions over the weekend were absolutely appalling.
Were terrible. Jeff, with VAR, is this the rise of the faceless functionaries and bureaucrats that George Orwell warned us about?
It absolutely is. I mean, for younger fans, I guess they spent their lives signing away, you know, Apple updated terms and conditions. Agree. It makes sense to them. You know, this is why so many young people wanted to stay in the EU, right? We just saw, I don't know how I made this.
You won, get over it.
I know. But I do think the VAR, it's not good. I mean, let's get down to the brass tacks of it. It's not good. It hasn't improved football. In cricket, you know, the decision referral system, formerly not, no one calls it Hawkeye anymore, but it works. It doesn't work in football. It reminds me of, you know, when you go round your mate's house and they go, oh, I've got this new speaker thing and it's really interesting because you can make them come out of this. But those things never work, do they? But the geezer that spent $6,000 on installing it will never admit that. He'll just get drunk and every time he'll forget how to do it and have to Google it. And I just think with it's not a problem at the lower league level. VAR, you know, it's not a problem with people being able to trap the ball efficiently either, but that's besides the point. VAR,
no.
it just hasn't improved football. I don't know why people can't step back and go, actually, it was flawed before, but it was better. It's so bad, VAR, that you sort of think there must be some other purpose to it. Like it's actually a covert data harvesting exercise by Huawei, who are actually filming the facial reactions of the fans to build some sort of consumer database.
So you're saying that there's elements that we don't understand. So if they get a VAR decision, you look up and like the moon's now a few inches closer. Like it's having an effect on the world elsewhere.
Look, man, I've been listening to some very interesting podcasts, Glenn. I'm just saying.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
Everything is not what, once you've seen it, you can't unsee it.
The problem is that ultimately, despite it being like really high-tech stuff, it ultimately comes down to a human then making the decision at the end of it. And I think they should just feed the whole thing through like FIFA, because FIFA never gets it wrong. If they can do that, then there's no one's ever going to get it wrong. No one, it will never be wrong again, ever.
There you go. Mike Riley, are you listening? Probably not.
Sorry, Ian, your two references, you've as a film, you said Scent of a Woman, and then you've just pulled out Mike Riley. We're going Dermot Gallagher and Point Break? Come on, man.
Mike Riley is currently the head of the PGMOL, although not for much longer. Howard Webb has been brought in as some sort of refereeing Sam Allardyce to save the day.
I don't know how you think you've pulled back some credibility by actually knowing that. For me, that's bad in a different way.
I get a daily news report from BT Sport. They let me know the general goings-on at the PGMOL. Anyway... Anyway, it was, don't question me, it was Derby Day on Merseyside. On BT Sport last Saturday as the Reds took on the Blues in a dress rehearsal for a general election. And just like a general election, there were some diabolical decisions and it was a frustrating day for all concerned. Leave it, Jeff. Anyway, Jeff, can I ask you, at the risk of getting 1,000 abusive messages on Twitter, what do you think of the Scousers?
They are.
Let me rephrase that. Are you a fan of the blood and thunder of the Merseyside derby?
I've got to say, for me, it's not like other derbies. I don't know why. I suppose because when you go to Merseyside, there's such a cohesive element. It's not quite as rancorous, maybe, as other derbies. It's a good day out. It's good for the city. It's good for the local economy. But I do think that Jordan Pickford, one thing that's what I'll get the complaints, by the way, for a bad accent, but I thought Jordan Pickford, I like the fact that he celebrated. Goalkeepers don't get to celebrate often enough. It's like, if you have an amazing game, you're lucky at the end of the game, people sort of go, well, yeah, that was good. And you might get a pat on the backside from a teammate. Whereas strikers have the absolute gall to a ball gets kicked and ricochets off their face and goes in and they're pointing to God. Like, yeah, I would point to God. Yeah. I was a goalkeeper, right? So obviously I see a lot of the nuances in what Pickford's done. Though. Those are some genuinely good saves, you know. A lot of what we call great saves are you'd have to move out of the way for it not to hit you. I mean, these were seriously athletic. But I once kept a clean sheet and at one point I dived to save the ball and knocked myself out on the goalpost, right? Carried on the game and then our striker, who scored a tap-in and a penalty, got man of the match. So I'm all here, as the kids say. I'm here for it. The Jordan Pickford wants to, you know, take his credit in the moment.
I don't know. I don't think you can get man of a match if you weren't conscious during the whole thing. But I think that's a base level rule you should have. I think we should go on further. I think linesmen should get to celebrate if they make a cracking offside decision.
Yes, absolutely.
Whip their tops off, cradle the flag if they've just had a baby, that sort of thing.
Can I just say at this point, Jeff, it is possible that you've forgotten that you were given man of the match in that game. Glenn, do you think it means more if there are more local kids involved in derbies? Shouldn't all the players in a Merseyside derby genuinely think they're funnier than any visiting comedian?
I think so to some extent, but in the Premier League, it hasn't mattered now for decades and we're so far away. We are years and years away from having a team where you'd have a majority made up of people who actually were born in Everton, raised in Everton and stuff like that in the first place. I think it's like, it's almost more of a derby if you've got maybe like four players who are just from the same continent, basically. That's sort of close enough. It's nice to see people really passionate about it. Again, viewing it through that Gareth Southgate lens, it was great seeing Jordan Pickford having an absolute belter. And at the same time, the downside was watching Trent Alexander-Arnold having another bad one. That was my main takeaway from it.
And on the subject of overseas players, what you often found, I always remember those Celtic Rangers games of the 90s, is that the players that were coming from like Eastern Europe would often be the most passionate. You know, you'd have some guy come on with a mad haircut and he'd headbutt a ball boy within 10 minutes to show the fans that he really meant it. So I think that it actually sort of balances it out because they're trying to prove themselves.
Hello, Ian Moore here. I'll tell you what I've noticed this weekend in the Premier League, and that is the shirts worn by Wolverhampton Wanderers players. They change colour depending on how much sweat goes into them, so you get dark patches all over them. It's like that 80s clubbing T-shirt fad. Was it the Wonder Fresh or something like that? Please stop it, Wolverhampton Wanderers. Please, just invest proper money in Prozone. Thank you.
That was Ian Moore there. There's nothing I love more than listening to Ian Moore talking about clothes. Now, each week here on the Football Zone, we chat to a BT Sport pundit about their trio of tremendousness, the best three teams, in their opinion, in this Premier League era. For this episode, it's the turn of the marvellously talented Joe Cole.
Number three is the amazing Leicester team of 4 years ago. Arguably not the best technically, tactically or mentally, but to achieve what they achieved on a budget, having been in a relegation battle the year before, you know, that is the romance of football. So they have to be in my top three. In second place, I'm going to go with a team that I thought was the best team I played against. It had talent all over the place. It had a beautiful balance of experience with exciting young players. It's the Manchester United team of 07 and 08. Ronaldo, Rooney, Tevez, all in their prime. Giggs, Scholes, Ferdinand, Vidic. Incredible team. So they'll be in second place. And in first place, very biased here, I'm going to go with Jose Mourinho's 04-05 team, which I had the privilege to play in. So I know firsthand how strong that team was. Broke records at that time in a difficult era, transitional era, I believe, in the Premier League as a manager that come in and revolutionised the game. And it was a real trailblazing team. It was so fun to play in. So they'll be in first place, my Chelsea team.
All right, Leicester in third. Glenn, we all love the romance of a club owned by a petrostate spending what is to them pocket money to buy multiple trophies. But Leicester winning the league with Claudio Ranieri in charge was the biggest story in any sport in any year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think it's one in retrospect where at the time it felt like, oh, this isn't even the best collection of 11 players in the Premier League. These aren't massive, massive names. But I think it's... the perspective's changed a bit in the years since when you sort of think, well, with Jamie Vardy and N'Golo Kanté, people like that, like these were absolutely world-class players across the team. It's just they weren't that famous. They just weren't as famous as the other ones that you'd find in Manchester United or anything like that. But it was just so... because it was so untoward, I don't think we're ever going to see that happen with the team again. Because also everyone kind of got behind it. They were kind of everyone's second team for that season. And I don't think that's ever going to happen again, because if it ever does happen again, everyone's going to go, oh no, it's the Leicester thing again. And I don't want it to happen to Aston Villa. And everyone's going to hate whichever team it happens to next. So I don't want it to happen again. It was perfect. It can never happen again.
Yes. Yeah.
I like the logic of that. I think it stands up because David and Goliath 1 week, David winning 1 week. That's great. That's a story. That's going straight in the Bible. David winning every week, you're like, do we need to restructure the whole stone throwing thing here? Because there's a lot of big Goliaths going under. A lot of people are employed in that. Goliath's got a coaching team. So essentially, I like what you said there, Glenn. It's extremely capitalist, and I agree.
Oh, but Jeff, please don't mistake this for an agreement. Okay.
Jeff. While we're talking about extreme capitalism, what about the Man United team of 07-08? Oh. Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez. Great team.
Yeah. I mean, Tevez was ahead of his time, wasn't he? In the sense that he was owned in a dystopian way by a sinister hedge fund. It's just bizarre, wasn't it? He was leveraged. It's just a new thing.
He was
leveraged. There was people's pensions depended on Tevez. That's what the game is all about, Ian. That is what the beautiful game is all about. And you had Ronaldo doing his thing. Am I doing a good job of making out that I know what's going on or has gone on in top flight football? But that Ronaldo, I mean, what a play. I'm now being like your brother-in-law at a barbecue.
You were doing...
he could do it all.
Can I just say, you were doing an excellent job up to the point where you questioned whether you were doing an excellent job. I was gone.
Ian,
completely.
I'm stony. Tell me about that. That Ronaldo, I mean, he can head, he can run. I mean, he's got to be the ultimate player in my view.
I regret so
you heard
much.
It here first.
My opinion of that squad at the time was I thought, when I was a teenager watching it, I thought the only way that squad could be improved was I really wanted Michael Owen in the team. And I just thought, just every time I was watching them score loads of goals, I was just thinking, yeah, but imagine how many more they'd have with Michael Owen. And then they bought Michael Owen and it was rubbish. And I, as the first time I was really confronted with being that drastically wrong in my life.
Yeah, obviously, Glenn, he chose Mourinho's Chelsea 04-05 team. This is one that he played in. I mean, amazing record, most away wins, most clean sheets, fewest goals conceded, most wins in a season.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. Team. And just watching them that season, I know obviously they didn't win the Champions League that season, but watching them take apart like Bayern Munich and Barcelona as well, and with just so many goals as well. But I think the reason why it's considered such a good team is just because of what happened to Chelsea afterwards. It was just on the cusp of Mourinho going insane. And the season after that was when suddenly he started only playing like 4-5-1, 5-4-1, And it just changed the face of Premier League football for a few years. And I remember this because it Pro Evo started to become crap. And it was because it went from you'd play matches where you'd win 8-7 and suddenly you went to just scraping 1-0 victories because the entire game was being played in the centre circle. And that's what it felt like with Mourinho's Chelsea. Like from 2005 onwards, just the halfway line was being worn down to a nub and I hated it. And so I think that Chelsea team is the best because it was the last time that the Premier League really felt truly fun with Jose Mourinho as part of it.
Yeah, I think there's something in there. Ashley Cole never got over the halfway line after that season, did he, really?
No.
All right, so the transfer window slams shut at 11 p.m. on Thursday night, although at that time of the evening, I'd prefer if they closed it firmly but gently. I think I make that joke every year. The deepest pockets were, of course, all in the Premier League, where the gross spending was almost £2 billion, essentially the same as the other four of the big five put together. The Premier League accounted for 49% of all the spending across Europe, although half of that is paying the electricity bill for floodlights at evening games. Jeff, yeah. Man City, Chelsea, Leicester, for some reason, and West Ham have all been placed on the financial fair play watch list. Now, by watch list, do they mean that they watch as the clubs spend more money than they've earned?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? It's just like, you know how if someone starts flashing the cash and doing it all in readies, you know, like if you was doing a car dealership and someone bought a Ferrari in cash, you have to feel that there's some sort of reporting for it. That's not normal. There's something going on there. I just don't believe, I mean, I know that they say a lot of the Premier League's revenue comes from overseas. I just don't believe there are that many Nottingham Forest fans in Indonesia that are underwriting the spending that Nottingham Forest are taking. It's frankly disgusting. I mean, it's really weird. My politics veers slightly right of centre. When it comes to football, I'm a raging socialist. It does my head in. It's disgusting. With everything that's going on in the world, they're spending this much money. And I'm in League Two, all right? When you're in League Two, with AFC Wimbledon, all we can do is hope that the big clubs haven't noticed how good our good players are, right? So you just hope that you're discreetly being overlooked. Or that Fulham have got some 8-foot centre-back who needs a bit of game experience because he's ineligible for the Papa Johns. It's never been more different at different levels of the game. And I just no. Every time, it's like the housing market. Every time you think it's gone beyond the pale, it just grows more.
Yeah. Yeah. Glenn, Chelsea have a new billionaire owner who spent 275 million quid. This really reinforces Jeff's point. They don't appear to have acted like a team that are on a watch list. I mean, a watch list to me sounds quite covert.
I've got to say as well, they needed the players that they brought in. Like, I thought Chelsea needed Raheem Sterling. If you compare it to the Chelsea we were just talking about, 2004, 2005, that was the worst spending because that was when Mourinho was just buying players up so that other teams couldn't have them. Do you remember when he bought like Shevchenko, yeah. Balak, Deco, a visibly decaying Hernan Crespo with no intention of them ever making their way into the team. It was just so other teams couldn't have them. That was like, that should be illegal. But the rest of this is all fine. I think it's fine.
I mean, we have spoken before on this show about Barcelona essentially selling the family silver to fund their spending, which is obviously one way to fund transfers. Although if Spurs had to do that, where would they get the silver from? Sometimes I just do these for me. Jeff, are these enormous sums of money spent in the Premier League the sunlit uplands of Brexit that you spoke about?
Sorry, how can you say that this is... all right then. We are outperforming the continent. This is one area. Yeah, absolutely. We are... I mean, it's a kind of morally corrupt inflation, isn't it? It's a different kind of inflation. I just think that, you know, ultimately, who's paying for it? Do you know what I mean? It comes down to...
Hedge funds and petrostates, I believe.
Well, that's fine then, because that's never caused any problems.
This is where we're at.
The only downside is that I don't want all the best players in the world to be in the Premier League. So when it comes to, like, the international tournaments, like the World Cup, it was always quite exciting playing a team where basically none of them are in the Premier League and they feel like an unknown entity, and it's terrifying. Like when we played Brazil in 2002, it was like Rivaldo, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, Roberto Carlos, and it was terrifying. Yeah. And I enjoyed that because it was like, who the hell are these guys? Obviously, we were aware of them, but we never saw them play week in, week out.
No.
Otherwise, it's just like, it just feels like going to a speed dating event and there's your cousin. It's just you've just seen the same players.
I totally agree with Glenn. Roberto Carlos wouldn't have been as exotic if you'd have seen him in the Carabao Cup second leg. Do you know what I mean? At Stoke.
Yeah. He was never going to lift the Johnston's Paint Trophy, and I know that for a fact.
No. I mean, you're right, actually, in a sense that you're watching Brazil, you'll be watching Arsenal's forward line and one of their central defenders if he gets in. Glenn, how do the other leagues in Europe counteract the financial power of the Premier League then? Should the whole of continental Europe be sold to a royal family in the Middle East?
No, I think they've just got to try and buy up all of, like, Chelsea and Arsenal's and Manu's and Man City's sort of cast-offs, get them on sort of loans, build up those players and then try and keep them. They've got to try and do it the fair way. Because there's no, I really don't know what else can be done. I mean, like, La Liga's got a fairly sort of high spend, but I mean, I remember it felt like about 15 years ago, but you'd have, you know, even the Dutch league felt quite big, and PSV Eindhoven and Ajax were quite sort of big, sort of dominating teams. And it's just not happening now. I think you're just going to lose, I think, a fair few of the other nations, like the Bundesliga and stuff, I think is just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And then I think it will become like a two-party system where we've got a massive Premier League and maybe like a massive, like La Liga, and then that's it. There's no other leagues. And then that's the only way it would sort of get bigger. That's, I don't know what else they can do.
This conversation has got bleaker by the minute.
Yeah, I'm really sorry.
Yeah, I know. I've suddenly been sort of like, you know, in 5 years' time, the Bundesliga is going to be fully underwater.
Well, I tell you what, let's talk about managers on the edge just to cheer us up a little bit. Scott Parker was the first Premier League casualty as the man with a weirdly striped cardigan got his marching orders after Bournemouth's 9-0 defeat to Liverpool. When the figures were added up, he wore that £1,350 cardi for three games in the league, which worked out to £4.58 for each minute use of the cardigan. Jeff, £4.58 a minute seems a little steep for anything other than a wedding dress, wouldn't you say?
No, I'm not worried if my manager's wearing expensive cardigans. What I am worried is when they're giving enigmatic post-match press conferences and interviews, right? It's a sign that it's going weird, isn't it? I don't want to think of them sitting in the dugout thinking about epic riffs and similes and so on. Or it's like when you're going out, you know, Ian Holloway / Scott Parker / Stuart Pearce once. They always get sacked after that. Do you know what I mean? I don't want them doing like kind of memorable comic turns with Gary Newbon on the pitch side. Gary Newbon, I mean, I've given you stick for the scent of a woman. Has he been a pitch side reporter in the last 20 years? Probably not.
Imagine Des Lynam hearing that. I know. You're right, though. I imagine Scott Parker sitting there going, I've got the perfect haiku for this.
Yeah, or Glenn. Don't look at TikTok, because that's the problem. Once you've seen your post-match interview kind of like twinned with the streets and Mike Skinner, you get a bit of a sense of yourself. I just want old-fashioned managers. Get managers off TikTok. That's the advice.
Yeah, you got the sense that Roy Hodgson didn't even have a landline, and that, I think, sort of played into his hands.
Yeah.
Didn't even have a landline. That's how old he was. Glenn, Scott Parker got sacked after four games.
Yeah.
Now, it's a 38-game season. That is just over 10% of the games. I mean, all three of us have just got back from Edinburgh. We're doing 24 nights. If after the second show, someone came along and said, that's enough, I'm personally, at that point, I'd have taken that. But it does seem a bit premature, right?
I think it would have been a kindness, Ian. Actually, I would have seen it as a blessed relief. But I think that the board have got to, I think they've got to stick with their decisions. And I firmly believe that managers should have to stay until the very end of the season. Maybe you get a January transfer window for managers. That's it. But other than that, they've made the decision of Scott Parker at the beginning of the season. You've got to stick with that. No manager is in a better position for suddenly joining the league with, say, 10 games to go, or even, you know, just four games fewer than the rest of the managers. And I think unless they're incapacitated or they have gone insane, so maybe like Alan Perrin when he was manager of Portsmouth about 15 years back, that the manager should have to stay on until the end. They should have to go down with their ship. I fully believe Scott Parker should be there.
It is actually quite an interesting idea that I'd like to see explored. Bournemouth aren't the only strugglers. Of course, Brendan Rodgers has been complaining bitterly at Leicester. He said, I came to compete, I can't right now. I mean, Glenn, that's sort of a movie line, isn't it? You know, Tom Cruise,
I feel like that's been written,
a new head coach at Leicester.
It's been written for him, definitely. I don't imagine Brendan Rodgers has penned that line. It feels accidentally very good. But he's great, and he's proven himself to be great in the past, and we're only four games into the season, so like, just let him work it out. And if it turns out Leicester do get relegated at the end of the season, then I obviously apologise. But he's been good enough over the last few years. It would make as much sense as like, it's like when Ranieri got sacked as Leicester manager. And it was like no one was calling for him to be sacked. It was just like, obviously he's not going to have as good a season as last time. Just let him stay on. And that's 100% what should be happening now.
Jeff, having a go in public at the people who employ you never ends well, does it? And when you answer this question, I think it's worth bearing in mind who books you for this show.
Yes. Well, look, I mean, this idea, what we're talking about is, you know, managers being defenestrated in the same way that, I guess, our Prime Minister was. And again, I'd have to agree with Glenn that Boris Johnson should have been allowed to serve a full term. I think that's what he was driving at. I'm not 100% certain there.
This is turning into one of the worst moments of my life. I've accidentally, like, Slumdog Millionaire'd my way through the whole show by accidentally giving you real fodder
for party.
No, but I think that there's a point. Or just like the Tory party membership, then if they do get rid of them, then it should be put to the fans, shouldn't it? And we should have an epic 8 week long pointless like application process where essentially the club slash party sort of trash their brand like a Gerald Ratner's moment across a whole summer. How about that?
Do you know what? Two managers battling it out in debates on various news outlets over formations. I mean, who wouldn't watch that? 4-2-3-1, are you mad? The country will never stand it. Anyway, another team who've not had the best start are Nottingham Forest. Here's a tweet on social media, perhaps giving a clue as to why. Yeah, we had to change some of it. Imagine the Nottingham Forest summer signings doing their initiation songs in the hotel. It will be like Live Aid. That's pretty funny, actually. A lot of new acts there. There's no doubt. 21-22. We've talked before on this show about new player integration. Two or three is hard enough. 21 could prove problematic for on-pitch communication. Mm. Glenn, do you think, oi, you in the red with the curly hair. No, not you. Him. I'm in space. Might be the best they can do now.
What's it, but like the teams they're playing every week are completely different to what they've been used to for the past few seasons anyway. So like it is a completely fresh start. I think it's fine too. I'm just going by what I've done on Football Manager in the past. And honestly, the players have never minded when I've suddenly replaced 23 players with 23 brand new 16-year-olds who have never touched a ball professionally in their lives. I think this is going to be absolutely fine. They just need to rely on Jesse Lingard. They're absolutely fine.
I mean, this does happen, again, like, you know, at lower league level, this happens for a completely different reason. It's just you get there and you go, I don't know, we haven't got any songs yet. We have to bring in writers. I mean, football clubs will have to bring in writers for the songs because they need to be witty. It's what marks out the Premiership against some of our less humorous sort of competitor leagues. We've got great songs. That's the main reason the Indonesians are lapping up the Premiership. But at the moment, the turnover rate, we haven't got enough time. Ian, to come up with funny songs for players.
But you've got Lingard. Lingard's the quirkiest player in the Premier League. He does his dances. He eats roast dinners covered in pistachios with a mug of tea. We know that much about him.
Good man.
He's weird enough to do it.
You've got plenty to work with there, haven't you, really? Songwriters. Get to work, Nottingham songsters. If any of those bottom six teams do sack the manager, finding a replacement who can do the specific job of steering the team to safety would not be easy. There is no modern-day equivalent of Sam Allardyce. He was the last of the Allardyce, which was, in fact, the less successful follow-up to the Daniel Day-Lewis epic, The Last of the Mohicans. OK, let's have a game of Who Am I? I give out three clues and you have to guess who I'm on about. Here we are. I won the Champions League at 21 years old, having come through the club's academy 3 years prior. I played for Juventus, Inter and AC Milan. And I finished my career in League Two of the English Football League. Do you have any idea who I'm talking about here?
No, and I resent this question.
I'll give you an extra clue if you
want.
I am currently assistant manager of my national team, and I'm well known for an accessory that I have to wear on the pitch. And if you're talking Diamante, you're not a million miles away. Glenn. Any clue as to who that might be?
I think just because you said they had an accessory, I'm going to say Edgar Davids.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Right on the money. Yeah. Edgar Davids, that is true.
Davids, all day long.
Jeff gets half a point for agreeing. Erling Haaland, let's talk about him. He's made a great start to his Manchester City career. A scarcely believable two hat-tricks and 10 goals in his first six Premier League games. If he keeps going, he's going to break Dixie Dean's record and, like Dean, possibly end up with a hotel named after him in his adopted city. Jeff, would it be called the Haalandian Express?
Wow.
Thank you.
I admire that.
You're saying it like you don't, I've got to be honest.
No, because I laughed, but I didn't think as an audience you don't get the right to laugh and then groan. I laughed first, so the laugh is the valid reaction. With Haaland, great on the pitch, but these interviews, man, he gets his credit of being some sort of rock and roll punk footballer just because he deconstructs the questions poor old Gary Newbon's asking him pitch side, you know. it's, anyone can do that. He says, are you pleased about the goals you scored? Oh no, I'm disappointed. What? Oh, you're brilliant, mate. He's trying to do a job. What else do you expect him to say? You know, he's dealing with footballers mostly that aren't the brightest, all right? He has to keep it simple. So when he says, oh, are you pleased with the win? Just say, yeah, the lads are delighted. Rather than, what do you want, counselling by the pitch? Do you want the pitch side reporter to get really into it and go, Harlan, why do you think you play football? Is it stuff to do with your dad? Is it, you know, do you think there's something deeper going on here? Did he never take your fishing? Just get straight answers, you bellin.
Well, it makes me wonder what questions was he getting at Borussia Dortmund? What are the Bundesliga reporters asking him that we don't? What poetic
deeper
things are asking him exactly about like, global financial crises?
I noticed that when you scored that goal, you did something that was reminiscent of one of the great clowns of the vaudeville period. Yeah. Yes, I'm glad you noticed.
Yes. Glenn, do you believe, like I do, that you could score goals at the highest level if you were getting teed up 8 times a game by Kevin De Bruyne or Bernardo Silva?
I wouldn't be able to do that even if I was allowed to hold the ball and just throw it into the net. I wouldn't. But Erling Haaland is the first player in years that I've genuinely been like scared of. I find him really intimidating, not just because of his prowess. He is stature-wise, he is terrifying. He's enormous. He feels like when you've gotten bored of the... when you know you've played FIFA for too long in the career mode and all the good players have retired, and so the game's just generating like these brand new players who don't actually exist, and all their stats are like 99 out of 100. Yeah. And they're just named after other... Also, he's obviously Alfie Haaland's son then. And it feels like he's got the potential to break the sport in a really bad way, that we need to find a way to just enforce rules to make sure that a player as good as Erling Haaland can't play, because we've just got to accept otherwise that, like, yeah, for as long as he's at Man City, they're probably gonna win. I find him so intimidating.
That's an interesting question. I mean, do you think there should be some sort of handicap system then, Jeff? Perhaps maybe he has to, like horse racing, maybe he has to play with a small man on his back.
I think that might be a bit politically awkward in 2022. I don't know how you interview for that job.
And also they've sold Raheem Sterling, so what can they do? You know?
I'm also fascinated with Glenn, just how many seasons he's played here, because I'm pretty sure he said there that he was into the mode of the sons of players coming through. So that feels like 20 years, Glenn. I think I've been there, man. Yeah. People don't understand the careers that we've lived, other lives essentially, haven't we?
Yeah, you get to your fourth Maradona and you go, I've played this too long.
I'm Football Manager. I took Cambridge United to the European Cup, so you know, I know how you guys are feeling.
And then your ZX Spectrum crashed.
There does need to be something to introduce to stop Erling Haaland. In the same way that, like, I just feel like if there was a goalkeeper who was naturally born with, say, a bum so large that it fit the entire goal face, you'd have to put in a rule to go they can't play. Because either you have to not let them play, which isn't really fair, or you let them play and just accept that the sport's ruined for the rest of their career. And I just think that's what's going to happen with Erling Haaland. Manchester City, he's just going to get a hat-trick in every game.
Yeah. If that ever happens, well, this is where we first brought up the possibility. I mean, he's actually only had about 100 touches in those 6 games. Jeff, is he essentially the most efficient striker since Mick Lynch?
They're very good. You're on fire, man. You're on fire. I mean, there is one thing that I've learned about sport over the years is people do eventually get worked out, right? Do you remember Michael Owen at first? How do you ever stop him after that goal against Argentina? There's been certain batsmen in cricket. You know, Graham Smith went for a period where he got triple 100. It feels unstoppable. And then people watch videos. Something changes. I mean, just at the point where something seems unassailable, something maybe something within him will rupture, just a little bit of self-confidence. You know, like he'll go in a nightclub and only 98% of the people there will recognise him, and he'll just carry that for weeks. And it will affect his confidence in front of goal. So I he can't be any more efficient. I mean, you say that. He's definitely going to break some records this season. But I don't think it will be forever.
I think, actually, you're right. There needs to be something that breaks him. And I think this November, when all his teammates go off to Qatar, and he's basically in a footballing version of Home Alone, where he has to defend the Etihad from burglars, I think that might change his career dramatically.
And they all come back, Erling's changed. Hey, Erling, do you want to show us some photos of what you've been up
yeah.
to? No, poor fella. Even with Erling Haaland up front, City couldn't beat Aston Villa at the weekend. Now, up to that point, there had been dark mutterings all over Twitter about Stevie G's tenure as Villa manager. Glenn, does all that noise matter if Barry from Willenhall, with his 25 followers, thinks Stephen Gerrard's playing the wrong formation? Should we sit up and take note?
I don't think so, only because the owners are billionaires and ultimately a lot of them don't have social media and don't really care. I mean, we were talking earlier about Claudio Ranieri being sacked, even though that wasn't something anyone was sort of clamouring for. I think Stephen Gerrard's got a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of goodwill towards him, and I think he'll be fine. And I think I know it was only a draw, but I think it's probably helped him sort of quite dramatically. And I think the thing that I think a lot of people will give Stephen Gerrard credit for is that what makes him a decent manager is that he essentially played and was effective and would have been effective in nearly every single position on the pitch, which I think gives him sort of a decent outlook as sort of manager. I think because there's always that myth about what you want from a manager is someone like Jose Mourinho, someone who is bad as a footballer but had great knowledge of the game, so they get to be put in charge of 11 players who are so much better than they ever were, and they can just send them off to do their own thing. And that, whereas someone like Messi would be a bad manager because he would want 11 players to be as good as he was and not be able to sort of achieve that. I think Steven Gerrard's a nice sort of balance of that. I think he's, I think he'll stay. I think he'll stay in for the whole season. He's proven himself in the. What I'm trying to say is this is very thinly veiled. I'm in love with Steven Gerrard and always have been. He's my favourite player of all time, and I don't ever want to see him lose a job.
Right. I mean, if you think about Gerrard, Jeff, also say Frank Lampard, as Glenn alluded to there, they got their managers' jobs because of how good they were as players,
yes.
Right? I mean, it's a different job and there are only so many transferable skills. I mean, for example, do you think your teaching career has helped in comedy? And by that, I mean in the sense that you don't work for that many hours in the week.
And also I generally stand up in front of a room full of people who have no respect for me at the beginning and I have to try and work up to a point, like a fragment of respect by the end. I think that you're right in what you're saying. You know, like when you're a great player, it must be like constantly having your dad sort of trying to teach you how to drive, right? He knows how to do it. You do not know how to do it. He's going, why can't you put it in second? I don't know. I feel scared. We weren't close as when I was a kid. You know, stuff like that. And, you know, not everybody could sort of trap the ball and then to half volley it 70 yards, Dad. You know, your legacy comes with a lot of pressure. And, you know, with Lampard as well, I wrote on a sports show a while back called Play to the Whistle. You know, some said it was close in format to other sports-based panel shows at the time, but I refute that. But Lampard was on it. And you know, you think about it, you had it made then, Frank. You know what I mean? You were on a panel show with Bradley Walsh, Holly Willoughby. You were out of the game. But they just dragged you back in. So my advice with Frank, he's a lovely bloke. He's a really nice man. Why have to bother? Just get back on the panel show circuit, mate.
Okay. Do you know what? There's nothing you can say after that. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Now it's time for our regular quiz, Call Yourself a Fan. I asked 5 questions, 3 from this weekend's action and 2 of general knowledge. Here's the league table so far. Nathan Caton, Mark Simmons and Lloyd Griffith sitting proudly at the top with 4 out of 5. Jeff, by virtue of seniority, alphabetical order, and also because you're slightly needier than Glenn, you can go first.
No, I don't think it matters who goes first. Just everything Glenn has said has alluded to the idea he knows a lot about football. So it doesn't really matter. But yeah, first, whatever. Let's get this out of the way.
I'm about to really humiliate myself, Jeff, and this is all going to come undone. You watch me get zero.
Now we're doing the mind games, aren't we? Like okay. Klopp versus another man.
This is Fergie and Keegan all over again. I'd love it if this quiz was over. How many? All right, Jeff. How many away sides won in the Premier League this weekend? Was it 1, 3, or 5?
3.
No, it was 1. I love the confidence. You had no idea. The only away side to win was Bournemouth, of all teams, who under new management came back from behind to beat Forest 3-2. Question 2. Spurs beat Fulham 2-1 on Saturday afternoon, but who got booked for celebrating a goal that then got disallowed for offside? Was it Dejan Kulusevski, Alexander Mitrovic or Richarlison?
C.
It was Richarlison.
I didn't even know the name.
He thought,
and you didn't even say A, B or C. Woo!
I didn't, but you worked it out. It was beautiful and you got it right. Richarlison thought he'd sealed the victory in the 91st minute, whipped his shirt off, but jolly old VAR ruled that he was offside in the build-up. 1 out of 2. Question three, Brighton demolished Leicester City on Sunday with a 5-2 victory at the Amex, but who scored the opening goal? Was it A, you're happy now, Patson Daka, B, Pascal Gross, or C, Kelechi Iheanacho?
Say it was A, Pascal Jackso.
Close, but wrong in every sense. It was C, Kelechi Iheanacho scored in the first minute for the away side, placing the ball into an empty net. 1 out of 3. Okay, couple for your team, Jeff. How many red cards have AFC Wimbledon had in the league this season? Is it A1, B2 or C3?
It's one or two. I'm going to go for one.
No, it is two, Jeff. Two. Same number of wins as red cards.
All right.
1 out of 4. Looking good, Glenn. Which of these managers had the best win percentage as boss of Wimbledon, Jeff? Was it A, Nicky English, B, Dave Anderson, or C, Neil Ardley?
Nicky English. I didn't know we ever had a manager called Nicky English. It's tricky, that. I don't know. B, Dave Anderson.
No, it was Nicky English.
Oh, shut up.
He was unbeaten.
When did we ever have a manager called Nicky English?
I think you were still unconscious from when you played in goal in that game. 21 games you play. He played. He was your manager. He managed 21. His win percentage was 90.48%. Jeff,
can I just call a stewards on that? Because of my own disappointment. Is that a legitimate reason?
Yeah, okay, that's fine. Hang on a minute. The steward says you can do one. Okay, Jeff scored 1 out of 5. Anyway, it's the turn of Glenn Moore in Call Yourself a Fan. Glenn, you've got one to beat. Okay. How many 0-0 draws were there in the Premier League this weekend, Glenn? Was it A1, B2 or C3?
C3.
No, it was B. It was the Merseyside derby and Newcastle v Palace. Both ended 0-0. I'm loving the confidence of these answers. Okay, Glenn. Who opened the scoring at Stamford Bridge when Chelsea hosted West Ham on Saturday? Was it A, Jared Bowen, B, Maxwell Cornet, or C, Mikel Antonio?
C.
It was Mikel Antonio. Fumbled the ball into the net with a scrappy goal to put the Hammers 1-0 up. 1 out of 2. There were 5 different scorers at the City Ground on Saturday, but who completed the comeback for Bournemouth? Was it Dominic Solanke? I'm not doing ABC, you can work it out for yourself. Dominic Solanke, Jaden Anthony, or Kiefer Moore?
Was it Solanke?
No, it wasn't. It was Jaden Anthony. He made it 3-2 in the 87th minute with his first touch, having just come on. I don't know about you guys, I would love to do that. You know, just come on the pitch, score a goal, and then look at the rest of them and go, you can thank me later.
And then just take me back off and done.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even need to shower today.
That'll do, yeah. Okay, 1 out of 3. Darren Moore officially took the reins from Tony Pulis in March 2021. This is for Sheffield Wednesday. But who was his first game in charge against? Was it Rotherham, Rochdale or Reading? Glenn?
I'm going to say Reading.
It wasn't. It was Rotherham. They lost 2-1 to a 10-man Rotherham with a winner coming in the 97th minute.
Do you do a tiebreaker when the scores are this low?
No. Nobody cares. No. this is the decider. 1-1 going into the fifth. How many goals, Glenn, have Sheffield Wednesday conceded in the league this season? Is it 4, 7 or 10?
4.
No, it's 7. Glenn, it is 7 goals conceded in 7 games. Really, one of the worst quizzes I think we've ever had.
Oh my God,
Glenn,
I can't show my face around town anymore.
I don't think we should have a tiebreaker. I think we should both leave with this stench of disappointment.
This is bad stuff. This is really bad stuff.
Before we do, let's look at the updated table. Looking very, very, sitting pretty, not that pretty actually, at the bottom. 1 each. Now it's time for the Football's On Extra content. I'll chat with our two guests about a particular football topic. This week, we're going to talk about giant killings and whether it's something that will happen less and less. Jeff, 100 years from now, your lot beating Liverpool in the FA Cup will be a bit like one of those mythical tales told in Viking movies, except the protagonists will be way more violent than the Vikings.
Well, do you know what the funny thing is I'm doing a bit of revisionism at the moment, is it wasn't that big of a giant killing, right? Just bear in mind, that season...
You were seventh, weren't
we
you?
We were seventh. The previous year, yeah. We'd finished sixth. Now, I think last year in the Premiership, the team in seventh were West Ham and the team at the top were Man City. It would have been a surprise if West Ham had beat Man City in the Cup. We'd literally drawn with Liverpool that year. We'd drawn Liverpool that year, and the previous year, we'd beaten them at Anfield. Now, I get that... I don't want to take away from my own sort of football team's mystique, but just objectively, we had players that were knocking on the door of the England team. We were a tough side, you know. So, again, we go back to this David and Goliath thing. We were David and Goliath, but David was a well-drilled outfit, let me tell you. David had already taken down several kind of mid-sized Goliaths in the previous 2 years. And, like, it wasn't as much of a surprise to Wimbledon fans. It was just because Liverpool weren't in Europe at that time, like, no one was in Europe. Because Liverpool were the best team in Britain, we thought, well, that is like American baseball. We're like, they're the world champions. And they were a good side, but they were beatable, I think.
Wow. Do you know, I never even considered all that. And now it doesn't feel like much of a giant killing at all. Glenn, I mean, it doesn't. Glenn, if Manchester City draw Sheffield Wednesday in the Cup and they bring their B team, and that includes, say, Jack Grealish, is that not quite in the spirit of the whole thing?
It is, you know, I really want to see every team bring an absolute A team and destroy whatever team, whatever minnows they're up against. Really teach everyone a lesson. And I do appreciate it.
Rub their noses.
As a Wednesday fan, we're in an awkward position where we've been sort of like the last few, like even like the last decade, like sort of bottom of the Championship, top of League One. So it's difficult to sort of get a giant killing either way. But I looked it up. The only two giant killings that Sheffield Wednesday have ever really been involved in were in the 80s when we were in the first division and we lost to Swindon in the fourth division. And then another one in the 70s where we lost to Scunthorpe where we were in the first division and they were in the fourth division. We've only been... The killed giants, and even then it wasn't that impressive. I've never really been able to sort of experience that for myself. So frankly, I'd like to see a small team get absolutely obliterated, like to smithereens, where they have to rename the club afterwards. That sort of real lot.
Well, it's like Sizewell changing its name to whatever it did.
You know when like a non-league team get a bit far in the cup and then they have a game and like normally even if they get beat 5-0, they'll get clapped off and they said they did well to get that far. You mean like a result where it's so bad that they don't even get that? Like they get done so bad that the fans turn their back on them.
Yeah, but actually, dude. BT Sport wouldn't play highlights afterwards. It would be like when a player gets that injured, they don't show you it again.
I mean, it's interesting. I've only ever seen it from the other point of view. My team, Arsenal, we lost to Wrexham in the early 90s, lost 2-1. We were first in the league at the time. They were 92nd. That doesn't get much worse than that. And apparently in 1933... I was slightly too young to go to the game. Back then, Arsenal lost to Walsall, I think it was, and it made national headlines. It's pretty grim, of course, if you are an Arsenal fan. Jeff, slightly tangential, but we mentioned Nottingham Forest being back in the Premier League and recalling the glory days of 1979, 1980 when they won two European Cups on the bounce. Would that be considered a giant killing for Forest? I mean, they beat Malmo and Hamburg, I think, in the two finals. But they paid £1 million for Trevor Francis.
You just can't compare like what the champions, the European Cup, as it was formerly known. Because you look at the teams that they played in the final, wasn't it? Like IFK Gothenburg got to the final.
You know, Malmo.
It's
Malmo
like a bit like, you know, on social media, when it first gets big, if you get on early, you can build a following. You know, like TikTok. If you're an early adopter, you can do all right. But then the big boys find out. And so actually, at that point in time, you know, Forest were the champions of England. It was a good league. I don't think it's surprising, but I don't think it was a sort of typically a giant killing.
No. I mean, Glenn, how much do you know about Brian Clough and Peter Taylor? Have you seen The Damned United?
Yeah, I've seen The Damned United, and also my first experience of the Premier League would have been as like a three-year-old watching it on TV. And so because I feel like you're like the way you view like the whatever the top flight is, at your age is whatever your first experience of it was. So because the first time I ever encountered a Premier League, Nottingham Forest were a Premier League side, in my head, They've always been like a Premier League, or they're a side that should be in the Premier League. Like, it won't be long. I feel the same way about like Charlton, for instance. And in the same way, like the inverse of that is, I still think Manchester City by right should be languishing around sort of 13th. That's where they are, you know? And I know that's not true, but that's just where I see it. So like, yeah, it's because of Brian Clough. In my head, I'm like, and most people my age would see like, yeah, Nottingham Forest are meant to be, they're meant to be in the Premier League.
See, Ian's gone through about 17 generations with Man City.
Yes, I know what you were saying there, Jeff. I remember when they used to play in the local park.
The old Mancunians. Yeah, when, do you remember that game, Stoney, against the Fusiliers? What a game.
I do. Their superstar striker had to remove his pipe at one point and score a penalty. Jeff, we talked earlier about Leicester winning the title with old Diddly Ding Dong in charge. I mean, it was hard to resist, wasn't it? My team finished second that year and I sort of wanted Leicester to win it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, like everyone got behind Leicester is a weird sentence, isn't it? It's just not, no one's ever felt that way about Leicester for any reason as a place or a football team. But could this is why I don't sell tour tickets in Leicester. It's stuff like that. It's not even the proper Midlands, is it? Let's just do a roast of Leicester. But yeah, I think that there's a lot in what Glenn said in the main show about the fact that if that had just kept on happening, no one would have liked it. It's almost like a comet. You know, Halley's Comet comes around every so many years. That'll happen again in about 30 years. That's how long it will take for us to actually want that to happen. Mm.
Twice in our lifetime is just once too many, as far as we're concerned. All right, Hayleys, we know. Look at your tail. That's it for the show. Thanks to Glenn Moore, Jeff Norcott, Ian Moore, I'm Ian Stone. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next week for more of this sort of thing.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Member Week is back at Lowe's with big savings for pros. Now through October 15th, my Lowe's Pro Rewards members get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, tools, building materials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings before they're gone. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.